Peter Hill Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
The Way of Chuang Tzu, reading number 8, getting towards the end of the book, I hope. So this is a dude from 3rd century BC. He's talking about China, which sounds remarkably like, I think, Australia, with finance and people, honours, people. There's obviously not major religions, not Church of Scientology going on. People haven't really got this entire soul, haven't got sort of complexity of a heaven, you know, complex heaven. They have the heavens, everything. There's this really strange sense that because they haven't theorised with heaven, heaven has actually surrounded completely. That's my view. Okay. The inner law. He whose law is within himself walks in hidedness. His acts are not influenced by approval or disapproval. He whose law is outside himself directs his will to what is beyond his control and seeks to extend his power over objects. He who walks in hardness has a light to guide him in his all his acts. He who seeks to extend his control is nothing but an operator. While he thinks he is surpassing others, others see him merely straining, stretching to stand on tiptoe. When he tries to extend his power over objects, these objects gain control. I would agree with that. Of him, he who is controlled by objects loses possessions of inner self. He is no longer values himself. How can the value others? He no longer values others. He is abandoned. He is nothing left. Here is no deadlier weapon than the will. The sharpest sword is not equal to it. There's no robber so dangerous as nature, yang and yin. Yet it is not nature that does the damage. It's man's own will. Oh, apologies. If a man steps on a stranger's foot in the marketplace, he makes a polite apology and offers an explanation. The place is terribly crowded. If an elder brother steps on a younger brother's foot, he says sorry, and that's that. If a parent treads on a child's foot, nothing is said at all. The greatest politeness is free of formality. Perfect contact is free of concern. Perfect wisdom is unplanned. Well, I wonder what that actually means. Perfect love is without demonstrations. Perfect sincerity offers no guarantee. Advising a prince, the recluse Hu Si Kuei had come to see Prince Wu. Prince was glad. I have desired, he said, to see you for a long time. Tell me if I'm doing right. I want to love my people and by the exercise of justice to put an end to war. Is that enough? By no means, said the recluse. Your love for your people puts them in mortal danger. Your excess of justice is the root of war after war. Your grand intentions will end in disaster. If you set out to accomplish something great, you only deceive yourself. You love and your love and justice are fraudulent. Well, poor bugger of a prince. They are merely pretexts for self-assertion, for aggression, for action will bring it on another. And in the chain of events, your hidden intentions will be made plain. You claim to practice justice. Should you seem to succeed, success itself will bring more conflict. While all these guards standing at attention at the palace gate around the temple altar everywhere. You are at war with yourself. You do not believe in justice, only the power of success. If you overcome an enemy and access the country, you'll be even less at peace with yourself than you are now. Nor will your passions let you sit still. You will fight again and again for the sake of more perfect exercise of justice. Abandon your plan. Be a loving, equitable ruler. Try to respond. To the demands of inner truth, stop vexing yourself and your people with your obsessions. Your people will breathe easy at last. They will live and war will end by itself. That's all like that. I just think we have forgotten war. I think war will stop when we forget to have it. Oh, gosh. Stop here to hit off a few things. Active life. If an expert does not have some problem to vex him, he is unhappy. If Voss's teaching is never attacked, he pines away. If critics have no one to whom to exercise their spite, they are unhappy. All such men are prisoners of the world of objects. He who wants followers seeks political powers. He who wants reputation holds an office. The strong man looks for a weight to lift. The brave man looks for an emergency in which to show bravery. The swordsman wants a battle in which he can swing his sword. Men past their prime prefer dignified retirement in which they may seem profound. Men experienced in law seek difficult cases to extend the application of laws. Liturgists and musicians like festivals in which parade ceremonious talents. The benevolent, the dutiful are always looking for chances to display virtue. Where would the gardener be if there was no more weeds? What would become of business without a market of fools? Where would the masses be if there was no pretext for getting jammed together in a making noise? What would become of labour if there was no superfluous objects to be made? Produce, get results, make money, make friends, make changes, or you will die of despair. Oh dear. Those who are caught up in machinery of power take no joy except in activity and change, the worry of machines. Whenever an occasion for action presents itself, they are compelled to act. They cannot help themselves. They are inexorably moved like the machines of which they are part. Prisoners of the world of objects, they have no choice but to submit to the demand of matters. They are pressed down and crushed by external forces, fashions, the marketplace, events, public opinion. Never in a whole lifetime do they recover the right man, the act of life. What a pity. Here you go. This is a bit of a joy, Monkey Mountains. I've missed monkeys and monkeys getting angry and asking for things, and the silk hat salesman going here. Monkey Mountain. The Prince of Wu took a boat to Monkey Mountain. As soon as the monkeys saw him, they all fled in panic and hid in the treetops. One monkey, however, remained completely unconcerned, swinging from branch to branch. An extraordinary display. The prince shot an arrow at the monkey, but the monkey desperately caught the arrow in mid-flight. At this, the prince ordered his attendants to make a counterattack. In an instant, the monkey was shot full of arrows and fell dead. Then the monkey returned to his companion, Pen Pew. "See what happened?" he said. "The animal advertised its cleverness. He trusted his own skill. He thought no one would touch him. Remember that. Do not rely on distinction or talent when you deal with men." When they returned home, Pen Pew became a disciple of the sage to get rid of everything that made him outstanding. He renounced his pleasure. He learned to hide every distinction. Soon no one in the kingdom knew what to make of him. Thus they held him in awe. There's something to that. Don't be seen to be too clever. Good fortune. Master Key had 8 sons. One day he called the physiognomist, lined the boys up and said, "Study their faces. Tell me which is this physiognomy is 300 BC, my godfather. As a professional, tell me which is the fortunate one." After examination, the expert said, "Quan is the fortunate one." Key was pleased and surprised. "In what way?" The physiognomist replied, "Quan shall eat meat and drink wine for the rest of his day at government expense." Key broke down and sobbed, "My poor son, poor son. What has he done to this misfortune?" "What?" cried the physiognomist. "When one shares the meals of a prince, blessings reach out to all the family, especially the father and mother. Will you refuse good fortune?" Key said, "What makes the fortune good? Meat and wine, the mouth and belly. Is good fortune only the mouth and the belly? These meals of the prince, how shall I share them? I'm no shepherd, and a lamb suddenly is born in my house. I'm no gamekeeper, and quails are born in my yard. These are awful parents. I have no wish for my sons and myself to wander at liberty through the earth and heavens. I seek no joy for them and for myself, but the joy of heaven's simple fruits of earth." Bit profound for me. My God, it's going on. I seek no advantage to make no plans, engage no business with my boys. I seek Tao alone. I have not fought life yet. Now this uncanny promise of what I never thought, God fortune. Every strange effect has some strange curse. My sons and I have done nothing to deserve this. It is inscrutable punishment, therefore I weep. And so it happened. Some time after, that Ki sent his son to Kuan on a journey. The young man was captured by brigands who decided to sell him as a slave. Believing they could not sell him as he was, they cut off his feet. Thus, unable to run away, he became a better bargain. They sold him to the government of Qi, and he was put in charge of the toll gate on the highway. He had meat and wine for the rest of his life at government expense. In this way, it turned out Quan was a fortunate one. Cut off his feet. Put a toll gate. My God. This 300 BC, there's toll gates in China. What the heck is happening here? There's a toll gate. Flight from benevolence. Hu Yu was met by a friend as he was leaving the capital city on the main highway leading to the nearest frontier. "Where are you going?" he asked the friend. "I'm leaving King Yao. He is so obsessed with the ideas of benevolence that I'm afraid something ridiculous will come of it. In any event, funny or not, this kind of thing eventually ends up with the people eating each other raw. At the moment, there is a great wave of solidarity. People think they are loved. They respond to the enthusiasm. They are behind the king because they think he is making them rich. Praise is cheap, and they are all competing for favour. But soon they will accept something they do not like, and the whole thing will collapse. When justice and benevolence is in the air, a few people are really concerned with the good of others, but the majority are aware this is a good thing, ripe for exploitation. They take advantage of the situation. For them, benevolence and justice are traps to catch birds. That's benevolence and justice. My God, this is a deep one. Rapidly come to be associated with fraud and hypocrisy. Then everyone doubts. That is when trouble really begins. King Yao knows how dutiful and upright officers benefit the nation, but he does not know what harm comes from their uprightness. They are a front behind crooks operate more securely, but you have to see the situation objectively and realize it. There are three classes of people to be taken into account: yesmen, bloodsuckers, and operators. The yesmen adopt the line of some political leaders and repeat the statements by heart, imagining they know something, confident they are getting somewhere. Thoroughly satisfied with this, they sound their own voices. They are complete fools, and because they are fools, they submit in this way to another man's line of talk. The bloodsuckers are like lice on a sow. They rush together to where the bristles are thin, and they become to the palace and the parks. They delight in crevices between the sow's toe, around the joints, the teats, and under the tail. Here they entrench themselves and mention they cannot be routed out by any power in the world, but they do not realize that one morning the butcher will come along with a knife and swinging scythe. He will collect dry straw and set a light to singe away the bristles and burn out all the lice. Such parasites appear when the sow appears and vanish when the sow is slaughtered. Operators are men like Shun, who eats someone. The mutton is not attracted to ants, but ants are attracted to the mutton because of its high rank. So Shun was a vigorous, successful operator, and people liked him. Three times he moved from city to city. Each time, his new home became a capital. Eventually, he moved out to the wilderness, and there 100,000 families went with him to colonize the place. Finally, Yao put forward the idea that Shun ought to go out to the desert and see if he could make something out of that. Though by this time Shun was an old man and his mind was getting feeble, he could not refuse. But he could not bring himself to retire. He had forgotten how to stop his wagon. He was an operator and nothing else. So what is it? Yes men, what are they? Bloodsuckers and operators. I don't quite know what the operator is. The man of spirit is neither an intimate or with anyone, nor very aloof. He keeps himself interiorly aware. He maintains his balance so that he, in his conflict with no one, this is your true man. Let ants be clever. Let the mutton wreak activity. For his own part, he imitates a fish. Come on. Can't be too much. Fish. How fish swim, unconcerned, surrounded by friendly elements and minding their own business. The true man sees what I see and does not add to it something that's not there. He hears what ears him and does not detect imaginary undertones and overtones. He understands things in their obvious interpretation and is not busy with hidden meanings and mysteries. His course is therefore straight line, yet he can change direction wherever circumstances suggest. Tao. Cocks crow, dogs bark. This is all men knows. Even the wisest cannot tell whence the voices come or explain why dogs bark and cocks crow when they do. Beyond the smallest of the small, there is no measure. Beyond the greatest of the great, there is no measure. Oh, God. That's true. There is no measure. There is no thing. In the void, you speak cause. Or of chance, you speak of things where there are no things. This is sort of like intellectual rambling, which will wind up in quantum mechanics, I'm sure. To name and limit a thing. When I look beyond the beginning, I find no measure. When I look beyond the end, I also find no measure. Where there is no measure, there is no beginnings or any things. You can speak of course and chance. You speak and beginnings of something. Dost thou exist? Is then a thing that exists? Can it non-exist? Is there anything that exists that cannot not exist? To name Tao is to name no thing. Tao is not the name of an existent cause or chance. Have no bearing on Tao. Tao is a name that indicates without defining. Tao is beyond words, beyond things. It is not expressed either in word or silence, where it's no longer a word or silence to Tao is apprehended. And it's interesting how all Christian philosophy has got lost. I'm being eaten fucking alive by mosquitoes. Okay. Huizu said to Changzu, all your teachings are centered on what has no use. Chang replied, if you have no appreciation of what has no use, you cannot begin to talk about what you can be used. On earth, for example, it is broad and vast, but of all this expanse, a man uses only a few inches upon which he happened to be standing. Now, suppose you suddenly take away all that is not actually using, so that around you your feet is a gulf, yawns and stands the void, with nowhere solid except right underneath his foot. How long will he be able to use what he is using? Hughes here said it would cease to serve any purpose. Changzu concluded, this shows the absolute necessity of what's no use. Well, there you go. The gatekeeper in the capital city of Sung became such an expert mourner after his father's death, and so emaciated himself with fasts and austerities, that he was promoted to the high rank in order that he might serve as a model for ritual observance. Oh, there you go. You know, he wasn't expecting that. As a result of this, his imitators so deprived themselves that half of them died, the others were not promoted. The purpose of a fish trap is to catch fish, and when the fish are caught, the trap is forgotten. The purpose of a rabbit is snares to catch rabbits. When the rabbits are caught, the snare is forgotten. The purpose of words is to convey ideas. When the ideas are grasped, the words are forgotten. Where can I find a man who has forgotten words? He is the one I would like to talk to. I don't quite understand that one, but I sort of do. I do like flight from the shadow. There is a man who is so disturbed by the sight of his own shadow, and so displeased with his own footsteps, he determined to get rid of both. The method he hit upon was to run away from them. So he got up and ran, but every time he put his foot on the ground, there was another step, while his shadow kept up with him without the slightest difficulty. This he attributed his failure to the fact that he was not running fast enough. So he ran faster and faster without stopping until he finally dropped dead. He failed to realize that if he merely stepped into the shade, his shadow would vanish, and if he sat down and stayed still, there would be no more footsteps. Chang Zhu's funeral. Now, I wonder if this goes on too much. When Chang Zhu was about to die, his disciples began planning a splendid funeral. But he said, "I shall have heaven and earth for my coffin. The sun and moon shall be jade symbols hanging in my side. Planets and constellations will shine as jewels around me, and all beings will be present as mourners at the wake. What more is needed? Everything is amply taken care of." But they said, "We fear the crows and kites will eat our master." "Well," said Chang Tzu, "above ground I shall be eaten by crows and kites, and below by ants and worms. In either case, I'll be eaten. Why do you care?" What a beautiful thing. Seems logical. Now, and that's it. So here's a glossary, which I could... all I can say is Qian is heaven, Tao is the way, absolute and ultimate principle. Qi is one of the four basic principles of Yu. Qi, Qin is wisdom. Yu is the ethical and scholarly philosophy of Confucius. Jen is one of the four basic virtues of Confucian ethics. Jen is compassion and enables one to identify the joys and troubles of others. Zen, a school of Buddhism practicing direct institution on the ground of being. Thank you all for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. May you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.